Hello. I'm so glad to see you all today. It's just thrilling to see so many alumni and alumni. Just welcome home. I'm Sharon Davey. I'm the director of the University of Virginia Women's Center. And just one or two housekeeping things. If you don't mind turning off your cell phones or your Blackberries or your smartphones or whatever you currently are using, that would be very helpful. So that was one thing. Let's see, anything else? Oh, yes, I think you're going to want to make comments of your own. This seems very likely, or you'll have questions. And we've decided to hold them to the end of the panel. But there are microphones, one microphone right over here, so that you can come up and just make any comments or disagreements or additions or set us straight in any way you want to. So again, I'm very pleased to see you. The title of our panel discussion is UVA, Where We Started. But I want from the very onset to underscore something that I'm sure all of you know, that women were here as students long before the full coeducation of women in the college. The nursing school has a very long history of women at the university. The Curry School of Education also admitted women undergraduates long before the famous lawsuit took place. Women in the graduate schools were here much earlier, and I know because I came as a first-year graduate student here in 1968, a long time ago. And then much earlier in time, we know that daughters, sometimes relatives of faculty members, were allowed to attend the University of Virginia. I think that history is important, and we certainly don't want to be part of erasing it or making it vanish. But the decision to move to full coeducation of undergraduates was a momentous one. Full coeducation changed the character of our institution. I think the panel members today will attempt to answer some of the questions that raises. Why did it do that? How did it do that? What were the challenges that the university faced? And what about the women themselves? How were they greeted when they walked onto grounds and into classrooms? Why were some male students, faculty, and alumni against the move? Did they act that out? Who was supportive? What was the impact of having a court case, an ACLU court case, decide, in a sense, the fate of the university, even if there were some at the university who were actually working very hard to bring women on to fully coeducate? And finally, where are we today? Women outnumber men at the university today, as they do in many of our peer institutions. How does this shape the university today? So those are some of the kinds of questions that I'll pose to our distinguished panel members and to you. And again, I hope that you will keep that question or that comment in your mind as it comes up and come forth afterward to share it with all of you. Our panelists, starting over here to my left, Annette Gibbs, who was an associate dean of students. She was brought here really to facilitate the full coeducation of the university, and she definitely does not accept the title of the Dean of Women. In fact, she said if they offered the job of a Dean of Women, I don't know if she's kidding or not, but she said she wouldn't come. But she was very, very central in facilitating the experience of these new women. The next person in line is John Lowe. Ernie, I'm sorry. I have to stand here so I can see.
Two handsome devils, so I can see how you can.
Famous Ernie, who was dean of admissions. Very, very simple character. And of course, he went on to be the vice president for student affairs at the university. Finally, we come to John Lowe, the attorney from
representing the ACLU, or?
I was representing five young women.
Yeah, right, but also reflecting the opinion of the ACLU, representing those five young women against the university. The lawsuit was brought, and the argument was made that, in fact, full home education was something that would enable us to speak about this much more eloquently, but that was necessary under the law in terms of fairness as well and in terms of equality as well. Kevin Mannix, who came a long way to us from Oregon, is that from Oregon, who was president of student council when full co-education took place. So he was a central student leader, an influencer of opinion, and also I'm sure he heard a lot of opinions.
A rabble rouser.
A rabble rouser, okay. Okay. So those are the characters in our plot today. I'd like to start with Ernie and ask you who was involved in the creation of this transformative new chapter at the university. And could you give us a brief summary of how the plans for full co-education, could you give us a
brief summary of how the plans for full co-education were initiated and who the key players were?
Let me begin by saying welcome home. Nice to have you back. It really is. You haven't changed. How's that for a lead-in? You know, there are three points that. Thanks, Pat. There are three points that I would make to lay the framework for what came to happen in the year 1970. The first of which we can attribute to our president, who was tailor-made in Hollywood. There was no finer appearing spoken president than Edgar F. Shannon. And Edgar assumed the presidency in 1959. And his very first act was to hire a colleague from W&L by the name of Marvin Perry to come over and straighten out the admissions scene. Without elaborating, we had six undergraduate admissions offices, each competing with the other five, let alone with the rest of the world. That was not particularly good. So we got a centralized admissions office, point one. The second point, in 1967, Edgar established something called the Eminent Scholars Program. And that was the point in time that the university was engaged in the growth pattern that we still are engaged with. And the Board of Visitors were convinced to put $3 million on the table so we could go out and hire away from other institutions the finest of their faculty. And $3 million in 1966 was big bucks. It was big bucks. In 1966, for example, I was making $7,300 a year as an assistant professor of geology. Okay? So it puts things into perspective. Well, next point I would make, and I'll get to this.
Go right ahead,
next,
Ernie.
Next point I would make is that in the spring of 1967, on a Saturday, Petey called me, my wife called me, and said, President Shannon is on the phone, and he'd like to speak with you. So I went in and got on the phone, and it was a Mr. Shannon, Mr. Earn exchange. And he said, Mr. Earn, can you be in my office in 30 minutes? And I said, well, of course I can. Well, you know, dove into the shower and eventually went off to Pavilion 8, President's office at the time. And I walked in. The senior staff was there. Most of the Board of Visitors were there. And Edgar said, Mr. Shannon said, Mr. Earn, have a seat. I'll get right to the point. We have decided you're going to be our dean of admissions. Now, you know, you can jump out of your chair and say, you know, old boy network. But that's the way things played out, you know, at that particular point in time. And he said, will you accept that responsibility? And I said, Mr. Shannon, I have a heck of a research program underway. I had just come back from work in the Apennines of Italy, and I said, Mr. Shannon, I don't know a thing about admissions. He said, we've made arrangements. You're going to the Harvard Summer Institute. So, will you accept? I said, not now. I won't. I want to speak to Petey. And he said, we'll get together 8 o'clock Monday morning. Yes, sir. And that was the end of the meeting. Honestly, no, nothing else. Well, Petey and I talked, and I came back and said, yes, Mr. Shannon, I'll do it so long as I can continue to play with my stones and dirt. And he said, well, as you know, I teach in the English department. So that's how it all began. But in that meeting on Monday morning, with no one else in the office, he said, as you know, I submitted a request to the Board of Visitors for the University of Virginia to look into the prospect of co-educating. And he said, I want you to know that I'm committed, and if you tell me you're committed, we're going to do it. So there was no question whatsoever that the president of the University of Virginia was not totally committed to what eventually unfolded. I cannot say the same thing for our faculty. I cannot say, well, Kevin will speak for the student body. I cannot say the same thing for our alumni. 2-1 against, on the average. Faculty would say things like, will you teach a girl differently than you teach a man? And the response would be, no, wait a minute, what's this girl-man business? You know, let's get it squared off. But in any event, T. Braxton Woody, which many of you in this room might remember from your horrible experience in taking French, T. Braxton Woody was the chair of a 7-person committee to look into co-education, and they took 18 months to file a report to the president and to the Board of Visitors. That report was examined in full in February of 1969. And at the time, the board, not overwhelmingly, but the board did endorse this institution co-educating. They said to me, now, can you bring it off? And I said, well, yes, but this is February. And they said, we know, we're talking about a year from now, September of 1970. This was February of 1969. But we will provide the opportunity for the spouses of our students, females, as well as faculty brats and faculty wives to have the opportunity to come in this fall. And they charged Frank Hereford with the responsibility. Frank was the provost at the time, chief academic officer. They charged Frank Hereford with the responsibility of coming up with a plan. But the board had endorsed co-education at that point. Let me stop there.
Thanks. This is really a question for all of you, so respond as you will, but each of you I'd like to hear from on this. What role did you play in the process of initiating or encouraging full co-education? Yes, Kevin.
Do you mind if I stand?
Not at all.
I'd rather stand up here so we can see each other. I'm Kevin Mannix, Law 74, College 71, married to Susanna Chioka Mannix, Nursing 74, College 69, transferred after 2 years. I'd like to put a little bit of Mr. Earn's comments into context. Coeducation was a political process as well as a legal process, and Mr. Lowe will talk to the legal process and the leveraging that was necessary in the demand for equal admission for women to the College of Arts and Sciences, and the repudiation of the concept that providing an education for women at another institution was a substitute for providing women with an education at the University of Virginia. And while a number of steps were taken over the years to admit women in various ways, in small steps, the final decision that had been made as of February 1969 was, well, we're going to do something about it. This is the Board of Visitors. We'll start by admitting the daughters of faculty, all right, and then we'll have a committee that will decide on how to implement this. The committee that was appointed was a university committee, and by the way, I do laud President Shannon. I agree with Mr. Earn about that. In the background, he wanted very much to have equal admission of women. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But you had the faculty, which was obdurate. That's the nicest word I can come up with right now. The students were supportive but sexist and old-fashioned. It was girls in the college. That was the kind of tone we picked up on. But I have a disc. I went back to the platforms that we had when we ran in the college. And I ran with what was called the Virginia Progressive Party, and our first platform issue was immediate coeducation in the college, equal admissions for women. Let me move forward then and say, yes, I got elected as a college rep. I got elected as vice president. Later, I got elected as president of student council. The students were supporting coeducation, but they needed some growing up in education, too, about the attitude they might bring to equal admission for women. The political process that was at work, though, was the board was not there. And it was John Lowe, and yes, working with the ACLU, but representing five plaintiffs, who used the legal leverage. On the inside, I was the one undergraduate student appointed to this committee that was supposed to be deciding how to implement coeducation. What did they say? They recommended a quota system, a 10-year quota system, adding women, a few each year, to the college. And the issue at the time was, is this equal admission of women, or is this some sort of deal made to back down just enough to get by? And as an undergraduate, I wrote a minority report saying this is wrong. We should be admitting women on an equal basis. That minority report was endorsed by the student council. We made a lot of hay about it. Mr. Lowe was aware of it. It went to the Board of Visitors. We insisted that I be given an opportunity to speak to their Student Affairs and Athletics Committee about the minority report, because everybody else on the university committee had said, well, we'll do the 10-year quota system. That's our recommendation to the board. Well, the board was forced to back down because of Mr. Lowe, and because there was enough leverage demonstrated that students certainly were coming up with ideas saying, this is about equal admission of women. This also ties with one other political issue, which is the growth of the university at the time. The attitude that was presented by that committee was, well, we really don't want the university to grow, and the only way we can admit women is by adding them to the enrollment. And our response was, wait a minute, equal admissions does not mean you have to grow. It means you have to consider people on an equal basis and admit them on their merits and not based on gender. That is the nub of the political issue that was going on. We confronted the board with that issue, and with the legal leverage of John Lowe and his plaintiffs, they were forced to back off and come up with what a judge might accept, because we are clearly engaged in unconstitutional conduct, and what the judge would accept is a 2-year transition plan. It's sort of like temporary transition to get you into equal admission of women. So from my perspective, it was the legal system, our Constitution, yes, a university president who wanted to make this happen, and a Board of Visitors that was forced into doing this through a political and legal process with willing students coming together to advocate for the cause. That's my summary, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you.
I think let Annette and Ernie finish first.
Okay. All right.
I was going to be afterwards. I was going to let them set the stage, because I came when many of you came in 70 and had to pick up the pieces from all the things they've been describing. No, actually, I did. I came 3 months before the women of the class of 1970, charged with implementing and integrating and doing all of the things that we needed to do so that, in Mr. Shannon's words, women would feel at home like men at the university, et cetera, et cetera. And I, too, the first day I was here, ran into the thing about girls. Can you hear me now? Good.
Fine.
Anyway, we went through the thing about girls, and Kevin will remember this well, but it's student council meetings and all the student organizations meeting. It was kind of like, what are we going to do with the girls? That kind of thing. But in meeting with the women students, you know, we said, okay, if they're going to be men, you will be women. If they insist on being first-year men, you will be first-year women or students. So we got, you know, those kinds of things. But what was like life? What was life like that first year? Many of you well remember. What did we have here when you came for coeducation? We had Mary Mumford Hall, which was the only residence hall for women because the graduate women had lived there, et cetera, et cetera. There were no women's residence halls anywhere else. Mary Mumford was full. So what did we do? We thought for safety and security reasons at the time that it would be best for women to live on the third floor of the residence dormitories that were then called Alderman Road, and then the old dorms, you will remember, on the third floor of those. And that that worked out well for security because, and I think it also made some of Kevin's friend, the male students, more accepting quicker because they begin to feel protective, and they, if a stranger came in the halls or went up the steps, they knew. And that sort of thing helped. But life was hard. There were no residence halls. Can you imagine? There were not even sufficient numbers of women's restrooms. So many of you came, that was your greatest complaint. I don't have time to go to the nursing school or to Mary Mumford or to Newcomb Hall between classes to go to the restroom. I mean, most people seem to think, oh, I'll never get to live on the lawn because the guys won't let me, you know, and my gosh, it's dark out there and there's no bathrooms there. But there were a lot of those kinds of problems, as you remember. There were no athletic facilities. There were no intramurals, club sports, much less varsity. The men didn't even want to turn over the old Memorial Gym then because they wanted, you know, squatters' rights to that too. It was difficult for them for at least the first couple of semesters to welcome you into the organizations. Why? They liked the women students, but they didn't want to give up leadership positions to them. You know, they didn't want to share those kinds of things. And so it just took a while. And how did these kinds of things change? Not what the Dean of Students' Office did or I did, although I was out front there taking all the complaints from alumni and parents and these kinds of things. But it was because these women, you, knew that if it was going to be changed, you were going to have to take this on top of your academic programs and your academic life and help it move. And, you know, we had two things against us, for sure, when you came. Remember all the newspaper articles? If women come to the University of Virginia, the quality of academic life will deteriorate. You remember that? And the other one was, oh, if we allow women at Mr. Jefferson's university, the honor system will crash. So you had not only proven yourselves in the classroom as pioneers, but all of the other things too. We found out right away that you didn't want sororities, at least those first couple of years. You will remember that. That was too much like state U, and you had your own culture. You did want to get involved in student organizations, and many of you did. You really took the leadership in the university union activities, the short courses, and all of those things that we did. And we did everything possible. In fact, one of the best things that President Shannon ever told me, one day he said, "Annette, you seem discouraged about coeducation." I said, "No, sir, I'm not. It just seems extremely slow." And he said, "You know," he said, "do whatever it takes,
And if we don't have an activity, a service, or program, something that the women want started, well, that was all it took. Anne Brown, are you here? Started the declaration. Janet Palmer Hamill, where are you? I saw you, yeah. Saw you in the back. She began integrating the women into the resident staff program, came one of the chairs. And I mentioned earlier about the lawn. Oh, you can never live on the lawn. It's not safe. We're not going to share our places there. And the third year when Cynthia Goodrich was chosen to live on the lawn, is Cynthia, are you here? There you go, yeah. Thought I saw you. We thought, well, we're well on our way. And it was a degree-by-degree things. You made it, and the group that came after you that entered in 71 and 75, those two groups in particular were just really trailblazers. Not only did the honor system not deteriorate, it thrived. And not only did the academic quality of the institution not go down the tube, it thrived. And so I think it was a story that had a slow beginning with lots of problems, but that ended very well.
Thank you.
Before John jumps in about the legality of what transpired, let me make one lead-in comment, which I will follow up with. Why you? How did you get here? And I'll comment on that in due time.
Was that aimed at me? I will stand as well.
I think I need to put some perspective historically, background to the time that this all happened, for you to understand a little bit about where I was and where I came from. I went to the law school here, graduated in 1967, and for 3 years there, and I got a job downtown. The top trial lawyer in town was a lawyer named James H. Michael Jr., later a state senator, and he was in a two-lawyer firm, and I was lucky enough to get a job with him in my third year of law school, and then afterwards he retained me, hired me as a young associate. So I was there, and for about a year and a half, I had no idea we didn't have co-education at the university. It just never came up. I mean, I feel ignorant, but in 3 years of law school, now, 250 members of my class of law school, there were five women. Well, I suppose that's co-education by some definition, but it never occurred that this was a problem, that women couldn't come as opposed to just didn't apply. So that with that as background, after about a year and a half in practice with Senator Michael, for various reasons, I decided to hang a shingle. And I went out and hung a shingle, and I started doing civil rights work, which is very interesting. I didn't set out to do it, but people came, and I was taught in the law school that if you have somebody ask you to represent you and they have a worthy cause, that you have an obligation to do it. And if they have no money, then you're supposed to volunteer to do it pro bono. And I did a lot of that, and for a long while, I was the only lawyer within 75 miles of Charlottesville that would take a civil rights case. It didn't mean a lot to me. I didn't feel, but there it was. So one day, this very nice young woman named Ginger Scott came to me, and she lived in Greenwood, and she was recommended to me by, I think, a minister in Greenwood. She wanted to be supportive of all this civil rights work, and she knew that I was having financial, let's put it, difficulty. When you do a lot of legal work for no fee, it doesn't, after a while. And so she started working as a secretary for me for next to nothing, and we became very close friends while she was working there. And one day she described that she went to Albemarle High School, and she was a top-notch student. And I said, oh, I guess you'll be going to the University of Virginia. And she said, no. I said, no. I said, why not? She says, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? She says, they don't allow women. And I said, you got to be kidding me. I mean, that was exactly my reaction. I said, come on, get out. And then I looked into it, and I said, well, then we'll just have to, forgive my French, but old-fashioned, the truth be out, I said, well, we'll just have to sue the bastards. I was being humorous because I knew Edgar Shannon. He lived three doors away from me. I knew Ernie Earn. I knew others. God love Mary Whitney. And I knew there was a motivation there to go to co-education. So I was very optimistic that with the right push and understanding of making the case and a little bit of advocacy that I would help them to undertake voluntarily to see how we should co-educate the University of Virginia. Well, in getting set up for that, at one point I asked to have an audience with the Board of Visitors because I was told that while Edgar Shannon was in favor of it, the Board of Visitors had to approve it, and they were the stumbling block. They would not even give me an audience. They would not talk with me. I told them exactly what I had in mind. I wanted to talk with them about this. I said, we don't want to have to resort to the courts. I'd like to talk with you about something that would work out over a period of years. No, they weren't going to have any of that. So with that as a background, we end up, the only thing we could do, and there were five women, but Ginger was the lead person of it. We filed suit in federal court. It took a three-judge federal court because it was a challenge of a state statute, the University of Virginia, to ask that the court require the university to co-educate. Now, here's where it starts becoming like a Class C movie plot, because who does the university retain to be their special trial counsel but Senator Michael? And now we have the mentor and the protege. Come on, who dreamed this one up? And so we started going down that road. I had a very good friend who is a trial lawyer in Alexandria named Phil Hirschkopf, who is a very fine trial lawyer, and I asked him if he would work with me on this, which was going to be a big case, and he did, and Phil and I worked through this together. He's not here today, but he certainly gets equal billing and did a lot of hard work on it. And I have to tell you, at every stage, Ernie Earn hasn't changed a bit. He was 100%. There was no question in my mind. Edgar Shannon was 100%. Mary Whitney was 100%. There were a lot of people that were. The Board of Visitors, can you say curmudgeon? they weren't having any, and so we were in litigation. Now, we had Judge Merridge in Richmond, who's a very fine, nationally known trial judge, was the one who held the preliminary injunction hearing. And we had a very interesting set to there. The night before the hearing, I got a call from Kevin Mannix. And he said, Mr. Lowe, my name is Kevin Mannix. Do you know who I am? And, I've been living here, and I knew who Kevin Mannix was. I said, yes, you're the president of the student council. He says, that's right. I'm also the student representative on the co-education committee at the university. I didn't even know they had a co-education committee at the university. I said, oh? He said, did they deliver to you today for the hearing tomorrow the university committee's co-education report? And I said, actually, they did. And he said, that's very interesting. I said, did they deliver to you my minority report? And I said, no. He said, I didn't think that might possibly slip their mind. And he brought it over to me that night. And the next day, we had a hearing in front of Judge Merridge, and without going into any of the real details, Judge Merridge heard Frank Hereford, Senator Michael, introduced the co-education report. I introduced the minority report. We had a discussion, and Judge Michael said to Ginger Scott, who was there, she was the only one who was going for a preliminary injunction, she said, if you go to the University of Virginia under my preliminary injunction, and at the end of this year, the case is lost, you will lose all that time, you will lose all that money, you will get no credits, you will get nothing, you will have wasted a year. And to her credit, courage oozing out of every pore, she said, I'm going. And so that's how Ginger Scott became the first student at the University of Virginia. She got in on a preliminary injunction. Now we go to the fun and games of discovery and pretrial proceedings, which many of you probably are aware of. Each side gets to ask questions of the other, and you get witnesses, and so you can take depositions to find out what they're going to say, and we were going through this. And some of the things that happened, I couldn't make it up. The university had, I think they had three college presidents as expert witnesses. And one of them I do remember clearly was T. Marshall Hahn, who was the president of Virginia Tech and was a nationally known distinguished educator. I mean, he was really a brilliant educator, no question about it. There was another one, I may be mistaken, after 40 years. I was only 10 years old at the time, remember. But I think there was another one of the two was named Spurgeon. I may be mistaken, but there were three of them. And Phil and I took their depositions. And as I tell you, you couldn't make it up. One of these presidents said the reason that he said coeducation would never work at the University of Virginia is because women need more diminutive furniture than men do. I mean, what can you say after that? Phil and I looked at each other and said, and then another one of the presidents said, it wouldn't work here because women need to have a kitchen on the floor of their dorm so they can have coffee when they're studying at night. That was another reason why coeducation wouldn't work. And I thought, you know, these are educated, distinguished college presidents making these statements. I said, I just don't get it. So we finished up with that. We had an expert who many of you may remember named Kate Millett. Now, Kate Millett had this for her. She was the dean at Barnard College, which is where they had coeducation dorms. That's one of the first places where they had the men on the lower floors and the women on the upper floors for security, and it worked fine. That's where, basically, we got the idea here. So she came and she was our expert, and she had a tremendous sense of humor. She was a wonderful, colorful person, and she just had Judge Marriage mesmerized in this hearing. The question came up on cross-examination by Senator Michael, well, you know, isn't it true that you have all of these men's rooms and no women's rooms? And she says, oh, shucks. All you got to do is plant geraniums in the urinals and you've got a women's bathroom. And Judge Marriage laughed so hard I thought he was going to fall off the bench. So we got on into the trial, and on one of the early days, the three judges called counsel into chambers. And this is Judge Marriage, Judge McKenzie from Newport News, and Judge Craven from North Carolina, really distinguished judges. And they called us in, and they said, Senator, quite frankly, we're not deciding the case yet. The case has not been tried. We don't know what the outcome is going to be, but we're really seriously concerned that the University of Virginia could end up getting a very serious black eye out of this. And so we just wanted to let you know that if you think it would be prudent for the university to go back and reconsider, we're willing to give you the time to do that. We're not making any decision. We're not making any judgment. We're not certain any mandate. But if you want, Senator Michael was quick enough to say, Your Honor, we move for a continuance. And they granted it. And we broke up and we left and suspended all proceedings. And we went back, and Senator Michael got with, I wasn't present, so I don't know exactly what happened, but he did appear at the Board of Visitors, and about, I think it was a week or so later, I got word from him that the university had adopted our proposal, which was 40% the first year, 45% the second year, and no quotas the third year on, and said that they were willing to do that on a voluntary basis without a court order, and wanted to know whether that would be satisfactory. And the one thing that I had no doubt about my university is that if they said they were going to do it, they would do it. And the result is that we ended the suit by just dismissing it. And contrary to a number of things, including breaking and making tradition women at the university online and the University of Virginia magazine saying that the court mandated and the court ordered, not true. Our university did not require a court order. They decided to co-educate, they did it, and we trusted them and never asked for an order. We simply dismissed, and the university did exactly what I knew they would do. They followed through, true to their word, and the code of honor here is strong, and they followed through on it with full co-education. Somebody said, how could you sue your university? You're a graduate of law school. I thought you loved the university and all of that. And I said to them, well, you know, I had a son, and when he was 5 or 6 years old, there were times when he would either do something he's not supposed to, or he would fail to do something he is supposed to. I said, and I didn't reject him when he did that. Rather, I would take corrective measures to make sure that he did what he's supposed to, got back on the right path, as a sign of my love for him. And I said, that's what a university alumnus is supposed to do. We're supposed to help our university do the right thing. And that was what I was doing. I love my university. I'm an avid, rabid Wahoo. I cut myself. I bleed orange and blue and all of that. And I even sent my son to the university where he graduated, and he is an extremely educated young man. The one thing that I want to leave you with, anybody that's within sound of my voice, there is no doubt in my mind that my university, our university, would never have achieved the greatness it enjoys without coeducation. That's it.
I was going to ask you a question that I think you're preparing to answer, and that was, how did coeducation affect admissions, and did the admissions office have concerns about coeducation, and did the number of male applicants go down?
When we got the university coeducation report, it said that it was recommending up to 35% over a period of 10 years, and Phil and I said, you know, that could mean 2% after 10 years. There's no minimum guarantee, and that was one reason why we just, it was a dead, no question.
You've heard it. Okay. I am the product of a liberal arts college and a co-ed liberal arts college, and among the beneficiaries of such an experience for me is to have a wife of 55 years. And I'll tell you, there wasn't any question in my mind that the University of Virginia, I joined the faculty in 1962, that there was something missing. There wasn't much that an assistant professor can do about such things. But I mentioned the name Edgar F. Shannon, and I knew that we had a mobilizing force. No question. Gordon Burris will remember joining the admissions staff. Gordon was our tennis coach. And he just about knocked me down one day when he said, Ernie, can I come in on Saturday mornings to interview with you guys? And it was, guys, okay? Well, nobody likes to interview on Saturday morning, but there was Gordon. And so, you know, Gordon, I've told you in many ways, but in many times, on many occasions, thank you, you know. And it's been a lifelong experience. But the point being this, the admissions staff operates on a calendar wherein from September through the end of December, admissions personnel are gone. In the state of Virginia, there's a what's known as a college day / college night program. And whether it's in the daytime or the nighttime, 5 days a week you're out there. And they either send you to the boiler room or to the gymnasium, and you tell your story 3 times. And when you're not doing a college day or night program, then you're visiting contiguous institutions and meeting with guidance counselors. And at no point in time in my life was I any happier than doing that and being with young people. But I had a regret, a very deep regret, and that was after you work so very hard in building a class, then you go out and build the next class. There was a void. So that's why, in time, after 6 years, I became the vice president for student affairs overseeing SIN. And I did that for 20 years. 20 years. Now, this university had a flow of interest. And for the very first time, other than when vets joined our forces in 47, did the university's enrollment ever reach 5,000? We were at 4,700 in 1960. We were at 5,000 in 1962. In 1967, we were at 6,700. And the year we co-educated, we jumped to 10,900. So our enrollment increased by 3.5-fold in 10 years. In 10 years. In the spring of 1970, there was great unrest on college campuses. We called them May Days here. Students were boycotting classes. And we could see it coming right on down from the Northeast Corridor. And when it hit scenic College Park, Maryland, we knew we were next. Classes were boycotted. Students didn't trust anyone. Nixon had invaded Cambodia. The National Guard was called to Kent State, and four students were shot, two of whom died. Now, this is in the spring of 1970, before we co-educated. It was not the most opportune time to do it. Distrust, distrust. So that needed to be overcome. But taking a half step from there, Annette will tell you that we had committees studying what are we going to do for the students academically and extracurricularly for the women once they arrive. That's any different than what we're doing back then. No one ever told me what to do about admitting non-males. No one. And this is not the use of a personal pronoun. That's not my intent. My intent is this. There are only three of us in the office, Conrad Warlick, Jim Kennard, and I. And Kennard didn't believe in co-education. And it only took me 2 years, but Jim Kennard became our university history officer, much to his chagrin, when I congratulated him and called him back from Kent School, saying, Jim, congratulations, you're now our university history officer, because I got some money from Vincent Shea. And he said, well, what do I do? I said, Jim, we're going to decide what the university history officer does. But that's when the admission staff started growing. But we knew right from the outset that we were not going to fail. And the way we did that, we spent more time on the telephone. And in every instance, for every applicant application that we received from a woman, we were on the phone to the headmaster, the principal, the guidance counselor, anyone we could talk to, because the name we used behind closed doors. We want a gritty class. Now, what does that mean? That means you don't look for portals, you go through walls. We wanted the kind of person that we knew was going to be intellectually elite, they were going to be leaders, and they didn't know the word failure. Now, that's all subjective. The SAT doesn't help. Poor selection gives us an insight. But what was important to us was the fact that in that very first coeducational class, 83% of the women who enrolled, you, were in the top fifth of your graduating high school class. Now, truth, 65% of the men were in the top fifth. The next year, The men got the message. 74% of them were in the top fifth, but 90% of the women. We didn't have any question as to whether you could do the work. There wasn't any question. We had done our work, our homework. We knew you could do it. And subjectively, we had high confidence that in very short order, the leadership positions at this university were going to be usurped. So as has been pointed out, we added 450 women, 443 to be exact, that fall, and the following fall, 550 additional women, and then we went sex blind. And we, by that point in time, we did not have to make those telephone calls. And it also sent a very, very strong message to our Virginia applicant pool, and I'm talking about our Virginia male applicant pool. It sent out the message that there is expected to be a great deal of self-selection. And that's why this university has become what it has. We get the finest of what the Commonwealth of Virginia produces in our applicant pool. Just yesterday, there was a luncheon. There was a luncheon for retired faculty, okay? And we had President Sullivan speak to us. She was unbelievably marvelous, if that's appropriate, in what she said at a conviction. But one of the first things she said was this. You know, one of the first expectations was for me to have lunch with the governor, which I did, said she. And one of the first things he said to me was, President Sullivan, they were not on a first name basis yet, President Sullivan, first thing that I expect is that you're going to increase your graduation rate by 10%. And she said, Governor, we can't do that. We're already graduating 93% of our students. Listen, listen. We are in a very, very different competitive game now than was the case 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And you guys made it happen.
I wanted to ask Kevin and to speak about, if you will, what were the reasons that some students were against coeducation? And Ernie and Annette, I wonder about faculty and alumni. What kinds of reasoning or what kinds of messages came through from those who actually really opposed women coming?
It's a good question, because actually it was a subject of political debate, and there were the traditional political societies that existed at the university, especially in the college when I first arrived. They were run by the fraternities, and the fraternity men would get together and select candidates for student council. And student council was dominated by the College of Arts and Sciences, which was the largest institution. Some of us decided, even though I was in a fraternity, some of us decided that there should actually be a party system. And we created a party system so that candidates would run for student council based on issues, not personality. And again, I went back and I looked at some of the campaign documents we put together. And we began to raise issues relating to governance of the university, but also later on, some of the graduate students raised issues that were outside the institution, having to do with the war in Vietnam, having to do with human rights internationally, having to do with our relationship with the community. But I'll bring us back to focus on coeducation. We had an environment where we were challenging the failure of the university to affirmatively admit black students. We worked with the university to bring around a recruitment program to convince African Americans in Virginia and the United States that African Americans, black students, would be welcome at the University of Virginia. And that began to work. Change began to be implemented there. We continued to insist politically that equal admission of women was a necessary element of any egalitarian institution claiming to represent the public. And that was in our campaign documents, and the people who espoused that position were elected. And the people who opposed that position were, and they were fine students, don't get me wrong, but they were looking to the past rather than the future. Tradition. It's the way it's been. That tradition is a good thing, but sometimes you have to think about it and you have to talk about it. And we were challenging tradition. We started evaluating faculty. We began a process of asking students to fill out evaluation forms and publishing evaluation of faculty members in terms of how they taught, the content of the courses, and this was disseminated. That was a challenge to authority. Now, some of this may or may not have been healthy, but it certainly was part of what was going on. I think largely it was healthy, and it made a big difference in how this university thought of itself as an institution. In terms of the co-education issue, enough students came here who looked to the past that it was a continued political debate. There's no doubt about that. But those who were elected to represent them in a democratic process were students who came forward and said, equal admission of women is a necessary element of this institution. Now, I mentioned in my earlier remarks that there's still a lot of sexism involved here, and I was as guilty as anyone else. I went back and I found a 1968 edition of University of Virginia magazine about the girls at the university, and I was the photographer for that article. And there were education students and nursing students and graduate students, lovely ladies, and a very nice article about them, but it was about the girls at the university. I acknowledge now with a certain amount of maturity that we didn't get it, but what we did get was equal opportunity and equal admissions, and I think the political process, which had been opening up within among students, did make a difference in helping us understand once women arrived that these elite women, and because especially at the beginning with a two-year quota system, they had to be elite women, were going to be a powerful force for improvement at this university, and obviously they were pathfinders for folks who ever since have been a powerful force for this university. It's great to celebrate all this, but I also brought with me the May 15, 1970 Student Council Report on the Admission of Women. I'm not going to go into any. It's 40 pages long. But we were talking about all of the issues that were confronting us back then, and not having gone through childbirth, I can't. You know, I'm always told that it's very painful at the time, and later on you tend to forget it. We are tending to forget how painful it was at the time to force this institution to come around. And I'm going to leave a copy of this with the university for the archives because we talk about the challenges, but I want to say this is great. This report is dedicated to the women undergraduates entering the university in the fall of 1970. Still proud of that.
Credit's due. When I first came here, as I said, just a few months before the women, he really led the male students in a positive way toward co-education. He helped us get down the road much, much quicker, and I've always felt that had we not had Kevin at the time, we would have been much slower. Just a couple of things about why they were against.
Well, I was wondering about their – Kevin is obviously led a much more positive kind of movement. There were students and alumni and faculty who were not in favor of this, and I wondered what arguments did they use? What were they saying?
Everything unbelievable. Many things that John spoke about, except worse. The first few weeks I was here, I spent more time responding to telephone calls and faculty members and parents than I could do my job to get to be prepared for co-education. Many parents, and not all parents, but many parents were against, of the women who came, were against co-education because, as their daughters told us at the time, they had been here and they remembered how they treated women and ran up and down the road, and they didn't want their daughters to go through that. And there may have been some of that kind of thing, but most parents were really concerned that since there were so few women the first couple of years that, you know, we did not have sufficient lighting at the time. You will remember that. That was a real problem, and it took us several months to get that done. We had money. Mr. Shannon, you know, appropriated the money, but, you know, it took time to get it allocated and to take care of those kinds of things. Alumni and faculty, in all seriousness, were our biggest problems, at least for the first two or three semesters. Alumni wanted the university to be the university that they knew and had known for years and years. Status quo was perfect. Nothing was better than status quo, and nobody wanted to change anything. That was really bad, and they wrote bad, ugly letters to the editor of all the newspapers in the state, the Cavalier Daily. And our women students saw that. I mean, it was tough. Many people came to the campus to demonstrate, placards. You could come out in the morning from the residence halls and see all of these up and down Emmett Street and other places. It was just kind of a negative atmosphere, culture to overcome. The faculty, with all due respect, were the worst. And as I said, some of my best friends are faculty. And not all faculty, but I think faculty feared the unknown. They didn't know what to do. I had several, you won't believe this, but several phone calls and visits were like, you know, I've got women sitting on the front row of my classes. They have on dresses. What am I supposed to do? You know, it was that kind of thing. Unbelievable. I'll never forget, I had been here not quite a semester, and two well-respected senior full professors came to the office, and the conversation went something like this. Annette, you seem like a fairly decent person, but we don't want women here. You should leave. You could leave at the end of the year, and everything will be fine. True story. If Edgar Shannon, Mr. Shannon, had not reminded me before things got better that the university was really serious and that he and Eleanor Shannon had five daughters, I had to remember that many, many times. But guess what? You won.
Ever so briefly. You know the community. When we use a paperclip more than once, it becomes a revered object. If we do something more than once, it becomes a tradition. And that's the answer. I don't think they were sexist. They just didn't want change. That simple. And so when the turnaround came, it came in a hurry.
Thanks. Sure, yes.
I give you a little background. As I've been practicing for 43 years, and as I'm rapidly approaching the midpoint of my legal career, I run into these old grads of the university and the old male graduates, many of them. And it used to be about an even split. It's much heavier now in favor of it, but I'm either the devil incarnate or the Messiah, depending on which way they come down on coeducation. But mostly now, everybody really does accept it. The other thing, which I think is often overlooked, so many times you have a breakthrough of some sort legally, and then the people involved fizzle, and it's a disappointment. Ginger Scott was the first woman student admitted. She enrolled in religious studies, which was probably the toughest curriculum at the university at that time, and 4 years later she graduated with honors. That is a great thing.
There is so much more, but we have gone past our time. I just wanted to end with this information. As we speak, the class of 2015 is receiving admission decisions, and I think it's fitting that we discuss the admission of women while a couple of thousand women are learning their decisions that they will be able to attend the University of Virginia. Thank you. And I'm wondering if anyone wants to make a comment?
Those were fascinating comments. I'm Holly Smith from the class of 72, and I'd just like to ask Ernie Earn and John Lowe, have you written down the histories that you just told us? Because I'm sure we'd like to have that in writing. Thank you.
Short answer, no.
Okay. Anyone else? Gosh.
My answer is even shorter.
Oh. Dale, would you just like to comment? Yeah.
Okay. I'm Dale Miller Hill from class of 74. And it was because of this event, bringing so many important people together, that I contacted the Alumni Association and decided we should really film this event. So it's a small step for womankind, but and a giant step for, I hope, history and posterity. But, you know, there, some of this at least has been captured, and I hope that this will encourage everybody to do more and to write more. And we do have a project also to capture people's experiences, and also the Alumni Association is having this video history project. So I do hope people will tell their story as well.
Thank you so much.
Hello, my name is Virginia Scott, and I wanted to at the risk of sounding combative, I wanted to ask. Dean Earn a question. You talked about the jump in enrollment from 6,700 to over 10,000 in a relatively short period of time, and remarked that that was extensive growth for the university over a short period of time. I wondered if that was because the university didn't want to reduce the number of male students, and therefore they increased the size of the university to admit women, but not deny men a place at the university.
The class of 1969 had 1,428. The class of 1970 had 2,005. Women, Ginger, were added on to the growth projections that first and second year. And in the second year of coeducation, 19, the class that entered in 1971, and I'm just thinking now, the number of males admitted went down by about, well, just shy of 20%. So we thought, accommodating what the board and the case had asked us to do. On a Friday evening, a confessional statement. In 10 minutes, I have to speak to the Jefferson Scholars. So if I run out the door, I'm not running because of the next question. That's my confession.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, sure.
Remember, I talk about historical documentation. So this is May 15, 1970. This is from the Student Council report on the admission of women. There are two basic approaches talking about the admission of women. The first is that coeducation should be achieved by adding women to the current enrollment of men. The other approach is that women should be admitted as part of the entering classes, not in addition. The difference between these approaches defines the differences in planning for coeducation. Student groups pushing for coeducation, such as the Student Council, conceptualize the latter approach, that is, women within the entering class. Well, then this is self-critical. When they minimize the problems to be encountered in coeducating. Administrators are following the former approach, and they use this as one of, as their basis for wanting to go slow, close quote. Not too much more here. The university's approach dates back to the Woody Report, November 1968, which contained a minority report by Julian Biscoe. Mr. Biscoe made the point that, quote, unless we are to reject substantial numbers of male applicants, we should be compelled to enlarge our plant and our faculty considerably to meet the needs not of the expanding graduate and professional schools, but of a swollen undergraduate college, close quote. This attitude was further reflected in the Future of the University Committee's feasibility report on the admission of women. And I quote, basically, that's why they were talking about a quota system. We have to limit the growth of the university, so let's limit the number of women coming in. The dynamics were, we've gotten beyond that, but at the time, it was one of those dynamic issues that had to be confronted. And at least I'm proud of the fact that our students were bringing this up and talking about it so that we could identify the problem.
I think we're going to have to stop now. You need a chance to stretch and to move around a little bit. We're going to be hearing from President Sullivan. And I'll just end with the words of Thomas Jefferson, which surely include both genders. Surely at this time at the university, in fact, young men and young women are doing precisely this, learning. Knowledge, he said, is power. Knowledge is safety. And knowledge is happiness. And we all deserve that. Thank you.